Iran's reformists try to sway the vote today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Many reformists are barred from running in Iran's upcoming parliamentary elections, but they're still trying to energize voters, and for good reason.
The stakes in these twin elections will really determine the future course of the revolution for at least the next decade and maybe more.
More of my Tehran stories coming up on today's show. Also, America's thaw with Cuba continues as President Obama announces a trip to Havana next month.
There are some in Cuba, a lot of people in Cuba, who want to see things change and move in a more democratic direction. And I suspect that the Castros understand that as well. And that's another big reason why we're seeing this opening.
Plus, a Chicago band brings bluegrass to Saudi Arabia. All that and more today here on The World. Thanks for being with us. We've got a lot of great stories on the show today, including bluegrass from a part of the world where you would not expect it, and a lively discussion of the U.S. election where you would expect it, Canada. But first, Tehran stories. We're talking this week about some of the people I met last week in Iran. The World's Matthew Bell and I were on the ground in Tehran for 7 days. We've shared some of those stories with you already. Young people looking to the future in Iran, the ones between the ages of 18 and 35, are the majority of Iran's population. They're also thinking about politics in their country after 37 years of a Muslim theocracy. So today, a story about the desire for change in that system. You know, from the moment you arrive at the airport just outside Tehran, it's clear who's in charge in Iran. But if you don't get it there, the reminders are everywhere in the city. On billboards, buildings, street signs, and office walls, there are portraits of Iran's supreme leader. Ali Khamenei is seen with a gray beard, an easy smile, and a black turban on his head. That signifies he's a direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad. Khamenei is often seen with an image of the late Ayatollah Khomeini beside him, a reminder to Iranians that the religious leadership of the country is constant, that nothing has changed since 1979. True, Khamenei is the ultimate authority on pretty much everything, from politics to religion, economics to social matters, but the fact is a lot has changed since 1979. At a mosque in a well-to-do part of North Tehran last week, supporters of the Reformist Coalition gathered to hear speeches and talk about the parliamentary elections coming up a week from this Sunday. The crowd was mixed, men and women, 20-somethings and up. The final speaker was Mostafa Kavakebian, founder of Iran's Democratic Party and a reformist candidate for parliament himself. To my surprise, he did not mince words. Kavakebian told the crowd that the hardliners want them to stay home on voting day. But the revolution, he said, belongs to everyone. We are upset by the disqualification of reformist candidates. This is a process, though, he added. Everyone needs to get out there and vote, God willing. As the crowd filed out of the mosque, reclaiming their shoes, I met a 25-year-old named Parisa. She was wearing a black knit headscarf and a maroon jacket that looked pretty hip. She was happy to chat and wasn't distracted by a group of men who quickly surrounded us to hear what was being said. So tell me what it means to be a reformist today in Iran in 2016. Parisa said being a reformist means a few things. It's hoping that Iran can develop better relations with other countries, she said. It's about having peaceful dialogue with the rest of the world. We need that, said Parisa, for security, for jobs, and for reforms because the situation has been really bad for the past 10 years. The gentleman was saying earlier that if 60% of people went out to vote, the parliamentarians would be ejected. Doesn't that suggest that the parliament is not at all representative right now of the people? That's absolutely right, Parisa told me. Unfortunately, reformists have been pushed out in recent years. We hope they can unify for this election and win a majority. Parisa went on. She pointed out that supporters of the reformist camp are really discouraged after making serious political headway in the late 1990s, but little progress since. Parisa said this upcoming election is all about turnout. If we can get people to actually come out and vote, she said, it will make a difference. When I asked if the nuclear deal created some impetus to get more people to go to the polls, she said probably not. But then she told me that she had one final point to make before we said goodbye. As an Iranian, Parisa said, I've been ashamed of some of my government statements in recent years. But now, after President Rouhani signed this nuclear agreement, Iranians can be proud. And Parisa said, we are backed up by 2,500 years of history. After going to that meeting, I wanted to find out more about the elections coming up in Iran and the reformists taking part. So I called up longtime Iran watcher Robin Wright. She writes for The New Yorker. So we just heard from my trip to Iran, Matthew, my producer, and I found ourselves at that mosque at a meeting of reformists, some surprisingly candid and even strident rhetoric challenging the power of older hardline parliamentarians. Can you tell me what I was witnessing exactly? Should I have been surprised?
Well, first of all, Iran has always had a very feisty political environment, and its parliament can be as combative as the Israeli Knesset or the House of Commons in Britain. There's often very kind of dynamic, interesting debates on the floor of parliament, and that plays out even more broadly in the wider political climate, particularly during elections. And this election is interesting for a couple of reasons. First of all, you have this huge generational shift that the majority of the electorate today is under the age of 35 for the first time, in part because the revolutionaries called on women to breed an Islamic generation, and they did, and the population basically doubled in a very short period of time. And that left a generation today that is predominantly young, born after not only the monarchy, but born after the revolution. And because of their numbers and because they're connected to the outside world, there's a sense of greater expectations, particularly after the nuclear deal, the lifting of sanctions, and the re-engagement of Iran with the outside world. There are expectations that Iranians now want something more, much, much more, after a long period of suffering.
Yeah, so these young people see the future obviously differently from the old guard, but a lot of the reformist candidates have been disqualified. So how can these people actually advance? Are they kidding themselves?
Well, the Guardian Council, a panel of 12 Islamic jurists, vets all candidates, and they disqualified 40% of the candidates who enlisted to run for parliament. It's a staggering number, even with that. It's not just the reformists who are challenging the hardliners. There are also a wide array of centrists and kind of moderate conservatives who've also thrown their hats in. There is a huge political spectrum in Iran that we tend to simplify as hardliners versus reformers, but there are many who are in the middle, and that includes the president. And there are many who want to see some or all of the kinds of openings the president has supported actually come to pass in the new parliament.
How much did the nuclear negotiations that President Hassan Rouhani and his government brokered with the West, how much did that entrench even further the hardliners?
Most political analysts believe the hardliners constitute today about 20% of the population. And of course, they are deeply fearful that the nuclear deal and the reopening to the outside world will challenge their hold on power, that people will increasingly be swayed by, you know, their engagement with the West. And they're afraid that whether it's Western mores or Western culture will dilute the revolutionary principles. So this is a very volatile moment in the revolution's history, because the stakes in these twin elections for parliament and the assembly of experts will really determine the future course of the revolution for at least the next decade and maybe more.
Yeah, that sounds pretty consequential.
It is. And the assembly of experts is often not widely noted, but we're at an important juncture. The current supreme leader has been in power now for more than a quarter century. He is 76. He has had prostate surgery before. And there are many who believe that the next assembly of experts, which is much like the College of Cardinals, it will elect the current supreme leader's successor, and probably from among its ranks. It will sit for 8 years, and the actuarial charts would tell you that it will probably select the next supreme leader. Mm. So this election is particularly important for the man who will oversee and have ultimate veto control over political, social, and security operations in Iran.
Robin Wright, a contributing writer for The New Yorker magazine. Thanks very much for your thoughts, Robin.
Thank you.
It's official. Next month, President Obama is planning a trip to Cuba. That'll make him the first sitting U.S. president to visit since Calvin Coolidge in 1928. The announcement today is the president's latest move to open up relations between the U.S. and Cuba, a process which, by the way, Obama talked about as a presidential candidate. More on that in a moment. Jim Acosta is CNN's senior White House correspondent. And Jim, you've also got a personal connection. Your father left Cuba after the revolution, but just before the Cuban Missile Crisis. Just curious to know how Cuba was discussed in your family as you were growing up here in the U.S.
Well, yeah, my dad left Cuba in 1962. It was about 3 weeks before the Cuban Missile Crisis on a Pan American airline flight, because back then you could still fly Cuba to the United States fairly easily. My grandfather, my father's father, ended up staying there. That's sort of a typical example of what has happened to a lot of Cuban Americans over the years. Some families simply split up, and that's what happened to my dad's family.
Now we've got this news that this big flight is going to be Air Force One going to Cuba. Is this a win for the president, or is it more complex than that?
Well, I think they feel like it is a win. And I think if you look at the poll numbers, Americans overwhelmingly feel like there should be improved relations with Cuba. Even though Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz were very quick to pounce on this and criticize it, they don't really speak for the entire Republican Party.
Yeah, what is up with the pushback from those two Cuban Americans running for president, Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz? I mean, is it just about politics in an election year, do you think?
You know, I think politics explains a lot of it, but not all of it. You know, let's face it, if you go to Cuba, and I mean, I could tell you this because I've been there, you can't get on Facebook, you can't get on Twitter, you can't go and Google stuff. You know, it is not a free and open society. And so, you know, I can't say that it's a completely illegitimate view on the part of Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, because that is, you know, something that they believe as Republicans.
Jim, as you said, you went to Cuba in 2009, the same year Obama took office. How has his normalization plan with Cuba evolved since 2009?
Well, in 2009, this was sort of the beginning. He changed the family rules for visiting Cuba. If you're a Cuban American, they liberalized that policy to say, well, basically, if you're a Cuban American, you can go to and from whenever you want. And that was mainly the reason why I went down there in 2009. And then there was the situation with Alan Gross.
He was a contractor for USAID down there, as I recall.
That's right. Yeah. That really froze this policy that President Obama wanted to pursue. He wanted to pursue normalization with Cuba. But the Alan Gross situation was just a major obstacle and impediment. And once the Cubans and the Americans decided to link Alan Gross's release to the release of the Cuban Five, those Cuban prisoners who were imprisoned here in the United States on charges of espionage, that is when the dam broke. You know, my father and I were sort of shocked when President Obama first announced that he was normalizing relations with Cuba, because as Cuban Americans, you sort of think that, well, things are just never going to change.
So I got to ask you this. Now that your family in Cuba knows you're a senior White House correspondent on CNN, how has that changed your life? Is it like, wow, we've got a celebrity in the family?
It is remarkable to think that you could have relatives that just don't even know you exist, and you didn't know they exist. And now, because of what's happening, because of these changes, there is this opportunity to be a family again. It feels like, from this Cuban American standpoint, that just maybe things are moving in the right direction and moving in the direction of a lot of families coming together again. And really, who can be against that?
Jim Acosta, CNN senior White House correspondent, thank you very much for your thoughts.
Thanks a lot for having me. Appreciate it.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. The Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya is huge, biggest in the world, in fact. It's home to 500,000 people, mostly Somalis who fled the violence in their country over the past quarter century. Ben Rawlins talked about it on the show yesterday. His book, City of Thorns, describes Dadaab as a place the size of New Orleans, with all the problems of a big city but no real infrastructure. A place where residents struggle to meet their basic needs, while the Kenyan government prohibits them from leaving or working. The Somali extremist group Al-Shabaab contributes to the misery there through attacks and intimidation. Rawlins also introduced us to one Somali refugee who's lived almost his whole life at the camp. His name is Abdullah Hassan, but he goes by the nickname Fish. He had to flee Dadaab recently because of threats from Al-Shabaab. We reach Fish in Nairobi, where he now lives illegally. He told me how war pushed his family to leave Somalia for Kenya.
I came to Dadaab in 1992 with my mother and two other siblings. We were six and three of them died because of hunger. My father was killed in the civil war, a time when he was coming back from his farm. So that's when mom decided that we flee towards Kenya. We never had something to eat, water and all those things. So, yeah.
So life was tough in Somalia. It's not exactly any easier in a refugee camp. In the largest refugee camp in the world, Dadaab, how does one survive? How did you survive?
I have been there for like 23 years. It is very, very challenging across all your life, from food, from shelter, from income, from integration, you know, and all those kinds of life.
Given that very basic need of safety inside a refugee camp, how did Shabaab penetrate that world? Wasn't the UN providing some kind of peacekeeping soldiers to make sure that no extremists would get into the camp?
I cannot actually explain in the manner that Al-Shabaab came to the refugee camps, but we experienced severe kind of violence, activities, kidnappings, and shootings, killings. There were a lot of explosions. There were landmines within the refugee camps. And I was threatened, and my colleagues in the community were killed. One of them was killed in Dadaab.
On top of losing your siblings and your father, now I gather your wife has died from an ulcer. I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah, I have two daughters, and my wife died of ulcers, yeah.
Is the medical care in Dadaab just inadequate?
Very inadequate. Because you'll see there are a number of NGOs who really provide services, but they don't actually have the necessary equipment and services that they deal with.
So now, as I said, you're in Nairobi. I suppose there's a semblance of relative security compared to Dadaab, but you are living illegally there. What's life like given that?
Okay, in Nairobi, it is very difficult because you are still a refugee in Kenya, with the implication that you are a refugee. You can't be able to move. You can't be out of the camp. That's what's basically very challenging.
I gather you were arrested recently.
Yeah, I was arrested yesterday when two policemen approached a friend of mine, and I just had to intervene because he was a refugee. Now, when I intervened, they also asked me for my ID, but I said I don't have ID. So they said that you are no better than this man, so why should you have to tell us that to release this man? We just had to play around with them and then speak some good Swahili, and then we were able to pay like 2,000 shillings, and then we were released like that.
Your family is still in Dadaab. What kind of dilemma does that pose for you?
My mother is there with my two kids, actually. So if I get some money, I send them. I call them often. I talk to them, and they speak good Somali, and they are doing great. They are going to school.
When was the last time you saw them?
It was 2013, December.
I was going to ask you what the future does look like for you.
Okay, perhaps that's a very challenging question.
Yeah, I would imagine so.
I'm optimistic that I may go out of this country, Kenya, and get resettled, and that's where I perhaps will end up. It's just about time that maybe God has a solution for me in the next 1 year or so.
Inshallah, as Fish might say, really hope he does find that solution. Abdullah Hassan, nicknamed Fish, is a Somali refugee living in Kenya. He's lived almost his entire life in Dadaab, the world's largest refugee camp. For our next story, we're off to Koreatown. That could refer to any number of Korean communities across the U.S. because Koreatown isn't just one place. That's what chef Dookie Hong and food writer Matt Rodbard discovered when they set off on a road trip to do research for their new cookbook.
So Dookie, we went to Duluth, Georgia, which is not the place that many would expect to have this bustling Korean-American population, but we found like this incredible, it was kind of like a pocha, right?
Yeah, it was like a little hole in the wall, like old Korean movie posters, which was really kind of cool for me to see. Uh-huh. and then just a karaoke. So there was like, after you eat, you don't have to go anywhere. It's just like,
What struck me was that it was like, Koreatown is often thought of these really cosmopolitan centers. You know, New York, it's on 32nd Street and really bustling. In LA, they've got these skyscrapers and it goes for miles and miles. But in Duluth, it was this one Korean restaurant in an abandoned strip mall. And it was built like a movie theater. Mm-hmm. You know, finding this little pocket in America, in a place where you really don't find a lot of Korean Americans living, you know, in the South, and there's pockets, but when you go to those pockets, you discover these really passionate cooks who are cooking the food that you would find in Seoul, that you would find in LA. Koreatown really isn't a place. It's ethic.
Absolutely, it's a mindset. I think it really confirmed that when we were there, because there's no reason for Koreans to be there in the middle of Georgia, and the fact that there is, and it's not only that they're there, but they're thriving there, and they're you know, really just like, really being a part of that community. Well, if we had to pick a recipe that really defines kind of our cookbook, that one dish would be our kaibijim, which is a braised beef short ribs, but kind of our take on it is the usage of the crock pot.
Yeah, right? which is true Americana. You know, this is a dish that's typically made in a pan and done over fire, but we found in Koreatown, in America, many are using crock pots.
I think the beauty of it is, like you said, it's so American, like so iconic, but then the dish is so Korean. Yeah. Like, you know, we got Asian pears in there, soy sauce, we got dates, mushrooms, like it's a really hearty dish. And then we love the crockpot idea because it was one of those, you know, set it and forget it
type of deals. And often for me, you know, growing up, it's set and forget it is usually like a pot roast or sloppy joes. But when I tested this in my small kitchen in Brooklyn, I put all the ingredients together and I turned it on, went away for a couple hours, came back, and my apartment transformed into Koreatown.
Not bad, huh?
Not bad, Dookie. Nice job with that one. I mean, it smelled incredible. I mean, it was all these wonderful East Asian flavors. Mm-hmm. You know, I think my neighbors were kind of jealous. Yeah. I'm pretty sure.
What are you guys doing over there?
What are you guys doing down there?
Food writer Matt Rodbard and chef Dookie Hong. They're the authors of Koreatown, a cookbook, which is just out. You can find the recipe for crockpot kalbijim, a dish they just described, at PRI.org. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Terrified by the current state of American politics, Cape Breton says, escape to Canada.
As long as you're willing to become one of us, you have to leave your gun at home. You have to like the maple syrup and, you know, you have to be willing to accept that there is going to be universal health care, whether you like it or not.
More Canadian humor ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. A lot of attention on South Carolina right now ahead of Saturday's Republican primary there. But don't forget Nevada, where voters will caucus this weekend to choose a Democratic presidential candidate. Nevada will be the first state voting this campaign season with a sizable Latino population. 28% of the state is Hispanic. Joining me now from Las Vegas is Fernando Romero. He's president of the Nevada nonpartisan group, Hispanics in Politics. Fernando, lay out for us first what the demographics for Latinos in Nevada actually are. Mostly people of Mexican descent, first and second generation mostly?
It's approximately 81% Mexican and Mexican-American. Obviously not everyone's a citizen, but hey, we are all Latinos and we all do for one another.
Right. Now, the state itself, as I said, 28% Hispanic, which seems sizable. Do all those people vote their numbers, or at least the ones who are registered to vote and citizens?
Well, I wish that were the case, but it is not. But every election cycle, we seem to better our figures.
Yeah, what accounts for that increase in numbers?
The millennials are incredibly interested in politics. This go-round, I see a lot of participation from the Latino community. And normally, you know, we go out there and try to pull teeth a little bit. This time, we don't have to.
Are they representing their community because they see candidates out there that they really like and want to get them through, or is it just more participation because it's an active, young kind of demographic?
Well, that's a very good question, but the answer is none of the above. What happens is that there's an issue out there that is called immigration reform, and it seems that people talk about it and then they stop after the elections. And this time, I think the young people are not going to accept that.
Mm. So is that the key issue for Latinos in Nevada, immigration reform?
You know, there are many people who will say, well, you know, we Latinos are like everybody else. We're interested in education, health, the economy, which is true. But comprehensive immigration reform is an umbrella. Without getting that, everything else is secondary.
Yeah, we'll parse this out between the two parties. What will this mean in the Democratic race? This Saturday, the Democratic caucus in Nevada, Hillary Clinton's got a much bigger ground game in Nevada, but Bernie Sanders seems to be making a late push. Can he make inroads?
Well, no, the inroads are there. I mean, they're now he's the highway and interstate and everything else. You know, he has really made a major difference in what's going on now. And he is really having a number of young Latino activists being a part of his campaign. And these young people are doing a tremendous job.
Over on the GOP side, what's going on? Nevada Republicans, I know, are caucusing next Tuesday. 4 years ago, nationwide, 3 out of 4 Latino voters went for President Obama. In Nevada, it was an even bigger gap. Can any Republican in 2016 turn that around?
You know, if you're asking Fernando Romero would say Marco Rubio. Why? Because Marco Rubio has probably, well, he and John Kasich are the ones that are talking more positively about immigration reform.
Your Nevada group, Hispanics in Politics, is nonpartisan, but you were a longtime Democrat, right? And then recently switched parties.
Well, I was a Democrat for 48 years. That's a long time. And yes, I've been voting Democrat, hoping in hopes that good things happen. I'm not going to slam President Obama. I think he's doing a good job and has done a good job. However, he made a promise to our community 8 years ago that he never delivered.
That promise being say, immigration reform?
That's correct. And he, as we all know, had the opportunity to do so when he had the majority. He didn't do it. 9 months ago, when Hillary Clinton made basically the same promise I'm going to deliver within my first 100 days, I went to the election department and I changed my party affiliation.
You mentioned Marco Rubio earlier. He and Ted Cruz are of Cuban descent. Do they appeal to Latinos out west?
Rubio had his very young years here in Nevada. His parents were culinary union workers. People can relate to that. Obviously, Ted Cruz does not appeal to the Latinos on the west or the east or the south or the north.
Why is that obvious?
Because he is so harsh. And he has already said, with his eyes looking right into the camera, and he's saying, if you came here without the proper documentation, you will never be a United States citizen. And that is harsh.
Fernando Romero with the Nevada group Hispanics in Politics. Thanks for raising the curtain on Nevada's Latino voters for us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for your interest.
There's another important group of people closely watching the U.S. presidential campaign, even though they can't vote here, Canadians. And yes, the race for the White House is serious business, but that doesn't mean you can't have a little fun with it. Take this video announcing that Canada, the entire country, is running for U.S. president and making big promises.
How will we make America better? We'll open one free daycare for every closed Planned Parenthood clinic. We'll legalize weed so you can stop worrying about terrorists and start worrying about your cat stealing your ideas. Look, we know America is a great country. We just want to help you make it good again.
Yeah, my cat just stole my idea. The CBC's Laura Lynch has been following the race and joins us from the Spiritual Center of Canada, Toronto. We're still in this very un-Canadian phase, Laura, of the primaries, but Canadians care all the same?
Oh, of course. We are always paying attention to what goes on down there. Even if it wasn't this particular race, we care about what goes on in American politics because it affects us. But this year, I mean, given the characters and the candidates and the statements going on south of the border, you just can't take your eyes off of it. It's just unbelievable. Every single day there seems to be something coming out that just begs for parody or fun poking or something. And you know what? How often do you get the chance to do that?
Yeah, I could make an educated guess, but tell us, what candidates are getting the bulk of the attention up there?
There's this guy, what's his name again? Donald Trump. Yeah, he gets a lot of the attention from up here. It started as recently as a few months ago when he started making the statements about not letting any Muslims into the country and criticizing Canada for its stance on allowing in Syrian refugees. And while people would poke fun at him, there were also some serious efforts to strip his name from the Trump Towers that are here in Toronto and in Vancouver. Nothing much came of it, but he sure got people's attention, and it's carried on from there.
Who else are the Canadians following?
Okay, a couple of others. Ted Cruz, mostly because we can claim him as our own, even though he's renounced his Canadian citizenship. He is one of us. He was born in Calgary. And if you go to a website called tedcruzforamerica.com, it will direct you to a Government of Canada website. Of course, it's not his website, but you can see all about us and what makes us so great. And the other one I think that gets a lot of attention is Bernie Sanders, because people think of him as, you know, he's pretty much Canadian anyway. He's from Vermont.
Right.
And a lot of people suggest that Canada really only recently elected a handsome Bernie Sanders for prime minister. So there is a lot of interest in his campaign as it goes forward. He a lot of what he suggests is, in fact, Canadian in terms of single-payer health care coverage and that sort of thing. So he's not that radical for us.
In all the kind of humor, I'm sensing kind of an underlying Canadian fear, as if Canada is wondering collectively, really?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I don't think Canada is alone in that. I think the rest of the world is saying that same thing, especially when it comes to the musings of Donald Trump on the hustings. We perhaps care about it more than most because we have such a close relationship with our neighbors to the south. And what you decide as a nation affects us so profoundly that we feel invested in this.
A lot of people are wondering if Bernie Sanders could ever really be elected president, given that he is, as you say, basically Canadian in his views. What does Canada want out of a U.S. president?
Well, I don't think that that Canadians necessarily want to have someone who is Canadian, but I think they would like to see a leader who is willing to work with the rest of the world, who is outward-looking, who doesn't deride or denounce other nations' views, and can be a cooperative partner instead of somebody who is engaged in confrontation all the time. We do understand that we look to the United States to protect a great deal of the world, and we're cognizant of that, but, you know, play ball with everybody and don't pretend like you can do everything on your own without regard to the rest of the nations in this world. It's not an attractive quality.
You're basically saying that Canada doesn't want to be in the position where the United States is wearing the t-shirt that says stupid and Canada is wearing the t-shirt that says I'm with stupid.
You said that, Marco, not me.
And what'll it take to get Canadians to stop gaping at American elections like they're train wrecks?
Not going to happen. We cannot help it. We have to be watching. I mean, we certainly watched in 2012. And look at what happened then. You had Sarah Palin. You cannot help it. You have to watch. You just cannot look away. And gee, it's entertaining. And I dare say this is not a terribly attractive quality. It makes us feel rather smug and superior when we see those kinds of things going on.
Well, enjoy it. The CBC's Laura Lynch in Toronto. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Here's something to think about while you're sitting in traffic. A thriving city where a rush hour backup might involve just a few cars, and where the air is clean because just about everything runs on low carbon energy. That's actually the goal for the city of Stockholm. Sweden's capital wants to be completely fossil fuel free by 2040. And as the world's Jason Margolis reports, it's already well on its way.
Drive into the center of Stockholm during rush hour, and you're going to pay for the privilege, about $4. This idea, called congestion pricing, had been kicking around for three decades. Gunnar Solderholm, who directs the city's Environmental and Health Administration, says they had to convince people this wasn't just another tax.
We told people that this is not for the money. We want to improve the air quality and to reduce the climate impact from the city.
10 years ago, policymakers decided to give it a try, but only for a brief trial. Transport professor Jonas Eliasson is with the Royal Institute of Technology.
It was sort of judged as inconceivable before it happened. And once it happened, no one really wanted to go back. And then suddenly said, okay, so why on earth didn't we do this earlier?
With congestion pricing in place, air quality quickly improved by as much as 10%. Traffic fell by roughly 20%.
And you see the, I shouldn't say empty streets, but you suddenly realize it's suddenly possible to drive.
This is actually the main street.
I went for a walk during rush hour with transport planner Yusek Susilo, also with the Royal Institute of Technology. He points to a backup.
For Stockholm level, this is congestion.
This is congestion.
Yeah.
So there's two cars lined up.
Yeah.
We did see a bit more traffic, but Atlanta, this is not. Stockholm has other sticks to keep people out of their cars. Parking is expensive and gas is heavily taxed. But city planners offer plenty of carrots, too. Susilo has lived and traveled all over. He describes public transport here as, quote, marvelous.
For example, in here, because the bus is actually so frequent, then you don't actually need to check the timetable because you have a trust to the system that it will actually come.
The buses, subways, and trains are also clean and nice. I rode a city bus with tables so commuters could work. A table on a public bus.
Customer satisfaction is something that's really, really high.
Public transport also burns clean. The trains run on electricity, almost all from hydro, nuclear, and wind sources. The buses in Stockholm are powered by table scraps and animal waste.
You can actually see that one, biogas bus.
Let's dig into that fuel source a bit further. In parts of Stockholm, this is what happens to unused food and garbage.
The automated waste collection system we invented utilizes air to do all the hard work.
This is a video from the Swedish company Envac showing its underground vacuum system.
Through a network of underground pipes, the waste is then transported by air at speeds of 70 kilometers an hour.
It all gets swept off to a big biogas digester where it's converted to fuel. This system also keeps garbage trucks off the road, another small way to make Stockholm's air cleaner, cut climate pollution, and make the streets less crowded. City planners have a name for their efforts.
Promenadstad is the name of Stockholm's new city plan, and it translates as the walkable city.
That's Daniel Firth, a native Englishman who's the chief strategy officer with the city's transportation department. He says in Stockholm, they're continuing to build dense urban environments with work, housing, and shopping close together. He says the city thinks about climate change a lot in its urban design, minimizing pollution, building a city of tomorrow not for vehicles, but for people.
What attracts people is other people. And what attracts those people is walkable environments, cyclable environments, access to services, access to entertainment possibilities, access to nice parks. It's basically all about people. Cities are people.
Same goes for Stockholm suburbs, where dense urban cores surround train stations. Urban planners have worked hard to make Stockholm more people and climate friendly, but they're also lucky. They started with a compact medieval core. With the pressure on all of us to cut carbon emissions, I asked Jonas Eliasson how a sprawling 20th century American city without an extensive rail system could possibly replicate what Stockholm is doing. He says consider his city 10 years ago when congestion pricing was first introduced.
What happened in Stockholm was not so much that 10% of the individuals changed. What happened was that almost everyone changed 10% of their trips. Roughly half of the disappearing car trips went to public transport. But the other half, that went to other things. Changing departure times, reducing your number of car trips and combining trip purposes, for example. So in a different place, there might be other kinds of options.
Put another way, if we all make small changes in the way we commute just two times a month, it could make a big difference in traffic, pollution, and quality of life. For The World, Jason Margolis, Stockholm.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. Coming up in a couple of minutes, playing bluegrass in Riyadh. But first, there's panic in southern Australia. And not just any panic, I'm talking about hairy panic. Imagine tumbleweeds blowing, swirling, and piling up 6 feet high outside your front door.
It almost looks like big clouds in front of some of the houses.
Australian reporter Tegan Dowling is in Wangaratta. That's a small town in Victoria State, hardest hit by the hairy panic. She says people's houses and yards are literally blanketed by the fluffy stuff.
It's really started to impact on their lives. They can't get in or out of their houses at the moment. And they're spending up to about 8 hours a day. It's almost like a full-time job picking up all of this hairy panic. But it's been happening every day since Christmas.
Hairy panic is actually a type of grass, and it's native to Australia, says Richard Barley, chief horticulturalist at Kew Gardens in London.
The grass grows a panicle of flowers on the top. The panicle is that structure of seed of flowers. And so its generic name is panicum, and that's why it's called a panic.
Ah, so the panic has nothing to do with the plant's propensity to drive Australians crazy. Barley says the grass just has to be managed carefully.
It's to do with land management, it appears, in this case. A farmer who is no doubt very unpopular locally now appears to have let the grass grow. These tumbleweeds, when they get to a certain size and they've set seed, they detach themselves at the base and become windborne.
Looking at images from this town in Australia, it totally reminds me of those old Hollywood westerns. By the way, Barley says that kind of tumbleweed we used to see on the big screen was not even native to North America.
There's a classic example of a Russian thistle that, as you can imagine, comes from Eurasia, and it was introduced into North Dakota in about 1870 and contaminated flax seed. And when you look at westerns now, you see tumbleweeds blowing around the scenery. That's often giant Russian thistle, and it's become a very invasive and damaging weed, and that's one of the reasons why I and the Royal Horticultural Society are so interested in weeds, because when they get out of their natural place, they can become very invasive.
Back in Australia, residents of Wangaratta are being urged not to panic about their hairy panic problem, because as Richard Barley says,
it lasts a while and then it gradually breaks up.
Until then, folks in Wangaratta will just have to have their brooms, or better yet, their leaf blowers at the ready. Speaking of which, we've got a video of a guy with a leaf blower trying to calm the hairy panic. It's at PRI.org. Okay, listen to this and try to guess what's going on. If you know the surf rock anthem Miserlou, made popular by Dick Dale, there's some of that going on. Maybe a little dash of flamenco. Certainly a Middle East rock vibe. That is a big hint. Well, you could try to guess, but I won't make you. This is the Chicago-based bluegrass outfit, the Hen House Prowlers. This month, though, the Hen House Prowlers are a long way from Chicago, in a country that may be the last place on earth I think of when I think bluegrass. Ben Wright plays banjo with the Hen House Prowlers. Ben, where are you?
I'm in Saudi Arabia. Dammam, Saudi Arabia, right on the Persian Gulf. It was about 90 degrees today during the day as we walked around and soaked in the place.
But why Saudi Arabia? I mean, what is the link between bluegrass and Saudi musicians and music lovers?
Well, we're here for the National Day celebration in Riyadh, Jeddah, and Dammam all consecutively. And so they had us come over here to perform and then pairing us up with other musicians and things like that to kind of keep us busy and form some cultural bonds.
How's that working out? You forming some cultural bonds?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been incredible. It really has.
What kinds of sounds and styles and rhythms are you finding that, let's call it the common language between you and the instrumentalists you've met?
The oud player that we played with the most, and I don't know how common this is, but his oud was tuned like a guitar. He doesn't have any frets, but our guitar player, Aaron, was able to pick up the oud and play it really easily. And we were exchanging tunes back and forth. We actually learned a Saudi tune before we came over here called Yarim Wadi Takif that's very popular here. So the minute we bust that tune out, it kind of breaks down walls.
And do any of these musicians speak English, or is it all kind of done it through music?
A few of them do, but most of them speak purely Arabic. So it really does force us to rely on our musical language for sure.
How hard was it for a band of bluegrass players from Chicago to learn that song in the first place?
We worked really hard on it, I'll be honest. Like, taking the tune apart and figuring out how to translate it to our instruments was half of the battle, but then we actually found a guy in Chicago that teaches Arabic and had him sit us down and teach us how to pronounce everything.
Oh, good. Generally, what is it like for a bunch of guys from the States playing bluegrass to be in this conservative Muslim country for the first time?
It's been an enlightening experience. I think we came here with the same preconceived notions that a lot of people have about this part of the world. And it's definitely been dashed some. You know, the people here have been unbelievably friendly and welcoming to us. We walked around the Red Sea in Jeddah at 11:30 at night the other night and saw people picnicking and enjoying the beach like we would in the States. And we've really, on leaving here, feeling like we have a broader understanding, at least how the people are here, even though the politics still don't make a whole lot of sense.
I'm just wondering if you miss anything. Like, I think bluegrass and I think the Southern pig picking and beer, neither of which is permitted in Saudi. Are you able to adapt the bluegrass lifestyle?
Sure. I mean, public music performance isn't allowed here, which is hard to grasp. But we've been playing our songs and they love it. Last night we had a guy come up and request John Denver's Take Me Home Country Roads. So it's not completely lost here, that's for sure.
Wow, it was a Saudi who requested Country Roads.
Oh, absolutely. And when we started playing it, they got up in front of us. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. There was 15 or 20 of them all mouthing the words along with us as we played it. It was exciting, to say the least.
Very cool stuff. Ben Wright with the Hen House Prowlers. They're based in Chicago. He's been speaking with us from Dammam in Saudi Arabia. Ben, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
And that is the Hen House Prowlers performing with their newfound friends in Saudi Arabia. We've got video of that at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.